Last September 3rd, the day the Allies declared war on Germany, the National Broadcasting Company brought you a broadcast direct from the United States liner Manhattan in mid-Atlantic. On that occasion, you may recall having heard the voices of the Honorable James J. Farley, Grace Moore, Norma Shearer, and Elsa Maxwell. The National Broadcasting Company now brings you the first broadcast to originate on a liner in mid-Atlantic since that time. William Hillman, European director of Collier's Weekly, speaks tonight from the Italian liner Rex, which is en route to New York. This will be Mr. Hillman's first uncensored report since the war began. All right, Mr. Hillman, go ahead.
This is Bill Hillman speaking from the Italian liner Rex. It is 1:30 in the morning of the 163rd day of the war. The Rex is somewhere in mid-ocean. She is America bound. There are still some 1,850 miles to be covered. Europe lies only a few days behind us. We who are on board this luxury liner sailing from the war. We have passed one or two ships since leaving Gibraltar. Ships are not frequent today, even along this southern route. Yet there is no peril for mariners and men if they sail beneath neutral flags, such as the Italian or the American flag, and along this lane. Neutral flags in northern Atlantic channels or the northern seas that wash Europe offer little safeguard. We have sailed through the Mediterranean. European civilization began there. The fate of this civilization may again be decided in lands washed or immediately reached by the Mediterranean. If the deadlock of the western walls continue, the decisive battle may be fought in the Near East, in the eastern Mediterranean. Preparations have gone beyond the diplomatic stage in that area. Watch the formidable army General Weygand is mustering in Syria and the careful plans of the British and the Turks. General Weygand's army is a pivotal force which can swing around on a number of objectives. The most daring drive may be possible against the oil fields in Baku and Batum. With those oil fields out of commission, the military might of Russia not only would collapse, but Russia would cease to be of economic advantage to Germany. The five-month search for a battlefield between the contending forces may well end in the eastern Mediterranean. We have sailed beyond the Straits and the Rock of Gibraltar, which the ancients thought was the end of the world. Those who have any doubt of British naval power can get a lesson in contemporary history at Gibraltar. There, steamers and ships of many nations halt for search by British contraband and blockade authority. Who are these people who today sail on luxury liners to and from wars? They are the usual travelers on the edge of war. On this ship, you will find the trader, the envoy, the minstrel, and the scribe, to use somewhat colorful language. Only such people are today allowed to travel. Here on board are the businessmen, for businessmen defy wars. There are the minstrels, Gracie Fields, the English songster, and June Dupre, the Anglo-American movie star. There is Reginald Denham, the British playwright, planning to work with Gilbert Miller in New York. There is Alexander Korda, Britain's greatest movie producer, on his way to Hollywood. Yet this luxury ship, like other ships that still ply the Atlantic, carry even more important cargo, mail. How complacently we take for granted the mailman and the mail steamers. But once wars come and mails are interrupted, how different the world seems. As a matter of fact, when you come to think of it, the ordinary commonplace things of life are the real miracles, especially when you are suddenly deprived of them. In Europe today, the mails are slowed up, trains are curtailed, the lights are dim in many places, coal and oil are scarce, coffee and meat and other things are rationed. The common everyday things we are used to see on the table bring into our homes and yet scarcely notice, like the nose on your face which is always there, are in truth the very things that make life real, make existence expansive. I am not going to suggest that freedom is not the most important thing in the world, but as a reporter, I have noticed this, and striking me so in Europe today, that people yield their fundamental rights with greater grace than they give up the conveniences to which they are accustomed. I don't wish to exaggerate this picture, and it may very well be overemphasized, but millions can easier be led to death and to deprivation of civic privileges than be deprived of the ordinary everyday things of life. Tell a man he must give up free speech or be prepared to die because his country is in danger. How often, and that will not be very often, will he question you whether you are doing the right thing. But tell him he must do without coffee or bacon or suffer delay in mail or go without light, and he is prepared to say you don't know how to govern and someone else ought to do the job. Governments may ignore man's belief much longer than they can ignore their stomachs or habits. How else could tyrannies so long survive? The stomachs will probably decide Europe's fate. Within a week on this same steamer, Mr. Sumner Wells will sail for Europe as envoy of President Roosevelt. If I might risk a pun, just as a single swallow does not make a summer, neither will a single Sumner Wells make peace in Europe. Secretary of State Hull disclaims any mission for Mr. Wells except a long-term one. His visit is to see what possible action, principally economic, may be taken in the future when peace is possible. In a certain sense, this is like sending the electrician to a house on fire to ascertain where to install the new lighting system. It may be wise to see what remains of the house before taking all that trouble. Is there any man bold enough or sure enough to know during the next few months what the House of Europe is going to be like when this war is over? Mr. Wells might be in the position to suggest certain tempting economic solutions to induce the European statesmen to become volunteer firemen a little sooner and put the fire out before it really gets hopelessly underway. There was, I believe, a suggestion recently made by an assistant secretary of state that America's vast gold stores should be sent back to Europe for reconstruction purpose. Has Mr. Wells' mission anything to do with that suggestion? Such a solution is not going to be as simple as all that, but one thing is certain. The real worry of the United States is not whether it is going to keep out of the European war, but whether it can keep out of a European peace. I think the explanation of Mr. Wells' trip is much simpler. The United States has first-rate ambassadors in London and Paris and Rome to know what is going on and what is possible for the future. But we have no ambassador in Berlin. President Roosevelt is statesmanlike in his action in sending Mr. Wells to Berlin, for we ought to have more formidable representation there today if the United States wants to play a forceful role in the work of peace. The president's move in that sense is adroit and intelligent. Every move President Roosevelt makes to strive for peace should be encouraged. But can Mr. Wells guarantee the elimination of Mr. Hitler? I'm afraid Mr. Wells will find little hope for immediate peace in Europe. Can he produce that one condition Britain and France are determined to impose? Britain and France say they will not stop fighting until Hitler disappears or Hitlerism is crushed. I have just visited many capitals in Europe. I find not even the faintest hope of peace for the present. Well, I must now take you back to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Thank you, William Hillman. Mr. Hillman reported tonight from the Italian liner Rex in mid-Atlantic. This was the first uncensored report Mr. Hillman has been able to give you since war was declared. This is the National Broadcasting Company. ¶¶
Make-believe ballroom, all of which serves to identify the king of the saxophone on the air, ladies and gentlemen, Charlie Barnett and his orchestra, playing in the blue room of Maria Kramer's Hotel Lincoln, just west of Times Square in New York City. Our number one tune comes from the second volume of books in Charlie Barnett's repertoire. Marianne McCall will sing 720 in the books.
Jive becomes the looks. What's the number one request? 720 in the book. When the band begins to play, you should see the dirty look. If the leader doesn't say 720 in the book, it's something that you'll approve. Get you right in the groove to keep in step. You really gotta be hep, just be like the kangaroo. All the fishes in the brook, everybody's jumping too. 720 in the book.
Now the Charlie Barnett treatment to that oldie that's finding new favor over the dance floors of America. Again, the voice of Marianne McCall and Indian Summer.